The arbitrary. This is the last epistemological topic in the course. It's going to be much easier, I hope, than the ones on objectivity. This is not a topic you can approach from scratch. It presupposes some inductions in epistemology, but that's no problem because you've had them all that you need by now. And I'm going to wait, but instead of specifying the necessary context at the outset, until we reach the need for a given item and then bring it in at that time, a given earlier item. I'm going to state as the opening context only what you need to get started at all, and that's going to be the new method for all inductions hereafter. Don't collect everything you need. Just start, and then as and when you see you got to bring in something you knew, bring it in there. The method in regard to the arbitrary, the title is the arbitrary is neither true nor false, is just what we've done with many others. Try to make the concept as clear as possible. For instance, by using contrasts, multiplying examples across a range, playing devil's advocate, etc. And then once you get the preliminary definition of arbitrary, decide what inductions you can draw directly from the very data you use to reach the concept. So of all the previous topics, as you'll see, it turns out that egoism is the closest to the exact methodology that you use in this topic. Justice and objectivity are much too complex to be our pattern here. In fact, we only need one item as our context to get started here, and then using induction, we can go straight on. And the one item we need to get started at all is that some ideas are proved. Or if that word proof sounds to you too specialized, let's deliberately take a word that doesn't tie into all our previous epistemology. Some ideas have a basis. And that you can know basically from just living in a Western civilization. Now, why do I say you have to need this? This is reduction, whoever asked about it. Why do we have to have this? Because arbitrary can be reached only in contrast to this type of idea. If you didn't have the knowledge that some statements have a basis or proof of some kind in a generalized way, and I'm going to use basis or proof as synonymous and try to say just with basis, then it would be impossible for you to identify a statement as being without a basis. In other words, arbitrary. Now, we've already covered proof more than for what we need in this course. But it's exactly like you could not grasp orphan, that is, child deprived of parents, till you had the concept parents. And you can't grasp arbitrary, which is statement without a basis, till you have the concept validated or proved or with a basis. So, how then, given that we have the concept of a statement with a basis, which you can either get from Aristotle or common sense, how do we go on to grasp a statement with no basis and then go on to show that those statements are evil, errors, and don't qualify as true or false? I got three different cases. I have 10 great cases, but I'm going to blurt out three, truncated. Number one, because these are chosen to illustrate different points on the range of examples. I say that there's one man standing here at the podium right now. What is my basis? Direct perception. See me, hear me, you can come and touch me if you think you can. Now, that's a statement with a basis. Very simple. By contrast, I say there are two men standing here at the podium right now. Right here at this podium right now. You say, what's the basis? I just know. You say, but we can't perceive you. There's no seeing, sound, etc. I say, this guy's invisible. He makes no sound. And you come up to touch him. And I say, yeah, you can't touch him because he's made of very delicate atoms that give way at your hand's pressure. You say, well, how'd he get there? I don't know. How do you know he's there? Prove that he isn't. Now, the contrast here is really too simple to labor over. In the first case, a clear-cut basis in direct perception. In the other case, nothing except I say so, and then in answer to any objection, further I say so. None of them with a basis. Now, if it was all that clear, no one would have any troubles with the arbitrary. And it is all that, only the whole trick with the arbitrary is that only children say it this way. As soon as you get a PhD or become president, you wouldn't dream of saying that. So example two. Good first and then the bad. The one with the basis first. My past ideas influence my daily choices. What's your basis for that? Well, the easiest course for you to take is introspect. I hold such and such ideas. You see how they're influencing me today. Give the examples. And I can remember when I accepted them. So there's an idea accepted in the past, and here it is influencing me today. Or if, even if I don't remember influencing it, I know that this was an idea put forth by Aristotle without which I couldn't be functioning, etc. So I have conclusive direct evidence, plus we can integrate it to the future. Our present ideas lead to future choices. For example, I'm enraged at you right now, and then I hit you over the head with a hammer as my present idea influencing my future choice. Now, that's all an idea with a basis. Now let's say, in contrast to that, Shirley MacLaine channeling. And her claim is that her past lives influence her daily choices. Now, I'm making up the example, but for instance, she says she hates her brother because he looks just like a slave that she hated when she was the pharaoh of ancient Egypt. You got to have some reason to hate him, so why not that? Now, I'm going to have a dialogue for clarity where I will be the devil's advocate and work for Shirley MacLaine. And you will be you. You object, but we know that the soul is intimately connected with the body and the brain and can't survive its destruction. So there can't be any past life. Shirley MacLaine, oh yes, it can, because you're talking about the prosaic soul of science. That soul, I'm sure, can't survive. Or you're talking about the objectivist definition of consciousness. I'm sure that can't survive either. But who said that science or Ayn Rand knows everything about consciousness? We don't even know what consciousness consists of. It must have some kind of elements. And these nothing becomes, something can't become nothing. So these elements must have always existed in some form, even before this century. QED. Then you say, but if you don't know about these elements, or what they are, or how they survive, by your own statement, how can you say what forms they take before birth? I remember my past life. And you say, I don't. She says, I do, and you will. You will have the same basis that I have once you die. Because you'll see God, you'll remember this conversation. So don't tell me about a basis. There's going to be a real basis. It's coming. What's wrong with the basis coming in the future? Now, Shirley continues, you know what science, the whole thing about science is the hypothetical deductive method. Well, we put forth a hypothesis, and then we have a decisive observation to test it, but it can take years. Now, you never hold that against science and say, well, they don't have a validation now, therefore it's out. Not at all. Well, I'm exactly like a scientist. Just like Galileo, I'm making a future prediction. What's the difference here? Why is everybody persecuting me because I make movies? At which point, you think she's got a good case? At which point you say, well, I think there's a difference between you and Galileo. One of you has a foundation in present knowledge to make this hypothesis. and the other has not. And one of them is able to define in sensory terms, or at least reduced to specific sensory terms, to observations now describable, exactly what is going to find or not find that are to be made in this world, and how it's going to end the question. But your case, Shirley, is undefinable, because by definition, the senses aren't involved. There's no specific observations you can cite about seeing God. And there's no means of carrying out this, except your whole advice is, die and see. In other words, we're going to get this future basis only when by present knowledge we won't be around anymore. Therefore, I still say you have no basis. It's a lot of talk. It's not just the open, I say so, I say so. This is now tricked up to sound like argument, discussion, evidence. But it's talk which consists of arbitrary hypotheses and why we can't have evidence today but will somehow, someday. But in terms of what you have actually said, not one jot of actual basis, even of an early contextual kind. Nothing. Okay, last example. Now, Shirley MacLaine is an inherently mystical example. That is not always the case. The most advocates of the arbitrary do not invoke the supernatural on a strictly quantitative basis, because they're all PhDs, you know, in science. There's a major effort by proponents of the baseless to appear logical, rational, scientific, and unanswerable. On the face of it, it may seem, God, this guy not only has a basis for his claim, he's got it proved. And in these cases, a great deal of thought, I repeat, a great deal of thought on your part, mental work, occasionally elaborate, is needed to grasp that the claim is baseless. It's not self-evident that a claim is baseless. It is not self-evident that a claim is baseless. And this, the guy conveniently stands up and says, this is true because I say it, or because God told me. But they don't do that in universities. Now notice, I'm not saying it's not self-evident that it is wrong. We're not talking about right or wrong. The question is it obvious or not that there is no basis? And it is not obvious. Now, I'm going to reverse the order of examples in this last case. Let's take the bad one first. Better than this for bad, you'll never get. Johnny Cochran at the OJ trial, claiming a police conspiracy. Now, it would have been very convenient for Judge Ito and Marcia for him to stand up and say, I say so, and God told me. They laughed him out of court. He wouldn't dream of doing that, not at the salary he's paid, which is a lot better than movie stars. So these people are experts at concocting the arbitrary and concealing that it's arbitrary. He doesn't stand up and say, I made this conspiracy up out of whole cloth, we're desperate. On the contrary, he drenches you with this worldly fact, some of them actually true, and impeccable inferences sometimes. And here's just a few of what I could take 20 out of that trial and on that basis alone convince any jury. Furman planted the bloody glove. What about that? Is that a fact? Well, what's your basis for that, Johnny? Well, what about F. Lee Bailey's statement that Marines know how to do these things? Furman was a Marine. So that's evidence, right? But what about the fact that Furman couldn't have done it according to the circumstances that were revealed, including all the witnesses? Ah, yeah, but they're part of the conspiracy. So he could have done it. And he's motivated to do it because we had a conspiracy. Now that, you see, is the vicious circularity. You see, he's just going back again. Another one. The police lied about why they entered the OJ property in Brentwood. True, they did. But why did they? He's automatically saying, yeah, it's part of a conspiracy against OJ and they're covering up. Or did they lie because they didn't want to go through the hassle of getting a search warrant and maybe letting a killer on the premises get away? And this kind of lying is daily and routine by all police officers across the country because, given the so-called exclusionary rule, they're constantly in the position of lying or letting killers get away. The exclusionary rule, by the way, is the perfect example of something made up by the Supreme Court with no basis whatever. But that is not what we're talking about here. Or let's go on to another one. Now that you're reeling from the bloody glove and the lying police, what about the police being sloppy about blood collection and storage? Again, absolutely true. The only thing is, the LA police, from what I can gather, are sloppy about everything in every case. The question is, did this sloppiness and carrying around in their back pocket and playing soccer with it and so on, did that change the DNA evidence? And expert proved that it was impossible to have all of those OJ indications by a sheer collection of accidental manipulations. It's beyond the laws of probability. And to hear a brilliant presentation of that, read that book by Vince Bugliosi called
Outrage.
He takes that apart completely. If you took the DNA and hammered it, poured acid on it, the most you could do is obliterate it. You couldn't take somebody else's DNA and have it come up OJ's everywhere. So here we have a series of irrelevant data and or groundless interpretations of data piled up, obviously in the hope that the sheer accumulation will qualify as a basis, even though every single one of the constituent items is irrelevant. As just exactly like saying France is a brilliant country, but every Frenchman is retarded. Now let's contrast Cochrane to a reasonable situation. A defense team who would claim a police conspiracy and then produce an affidavit, or better still, direct testimony on the stand from, say, 5, 10 policemen involved in the case. And they would name the leaders, their motives, how many people knew about it, and how they all arranged to keep it secret. Now, I say, you would have a real basis to allege a police conspiracy. It wouldn't yet be foolproof, but it would be a hell of a starting point. And what you have to notice here is that precisely because a basis is given, there is a way in theory of refuting it, assuming it's false. Whereas the actual Cochrane allegation is irrefutable because there's nothing whatever to refute. You can go on anything. It just says you, says I. But, for instance, if Cochrane put forth all these witnesses on the stand, then theoretically, at least, the DA could come back and put on another witness who testifies that Cochrane paid $1 million apiece to each of these 5 or 10 policemen, and then the DA produces deposit slips from their bank accounts and then frisks them in court. And there's tickets to Brazil in each witness's pocket on a plane that's leaving at 4 o'clock. See what I mean? And then you say, there wasn't a conspiracy, but they're being paid off to save OJ. But the message of this example is that if you have a basis, even a mistaken basis, that is the opposite of spouting only irrelevant data and groundless interpretations. Even if no supernatural or sixth sense or anything like that is involved. Now, I could give you endless examples. Lara, you have terminal brain cancer. You see, I've just been given a clean bill of health. Well, this is a cancer with none of the ordinary symptoms. You say, but I feel great. Jesus Christ, that's the worst sign in these cases. And you can run through the rest: demonic possession, astrology, God, all the right-wing conspiracy theorists who think that the Council of Foreign Relations or Jewish bankers or whatever are causing the state of the world. All right, that's our raw data, our three examples. Now, where do we go for the definition of arbitrary? We said so far only a claim with no basis, not even a mistaken one, as against a statement with a basis. But now we got to induce, what is the concrete meaning of having a basis or of having no basis? Now, we just went by common sense so far. Something convincing to say as against nothing really to say. But that's hardly good enough, because in two of the cases we talked to Blue Streak and it seemed convincing for quite a while. So when does a series of words become a basis? And when doesn't it? In other words, what exactly is missing in each of the examples of the arbitrary as a result of which we say no basis? Now we go back over, just as we did with egoism, inspect the same evidence again to induce a deeper definition of arbitrary. We're right at the point now where we were as a child on egoism. Well, now you have to know something or be prompted. The obvious thing missing, there's no observations. No what you call probative observations. Now, there's two people on a podium, no evidence of the second. Police conspiracy, not a jot of anything you can observe. Shirley MacLaine's got a lot of evidence, but only after you die. So there's no observation. By the same token, no logical argument, because any argument is either circular or itself has no basis or is contradictory. There's no integration with past knowledge. Now, this is true in all three cases, but I deliberately stressed the Shirley MacLaine example because she's continually saying, your past definition of soul doesn't apply. Your past definition of consciousness doesn't apply. And in one way or the other, that always happens. Your past definition of man doesn't apply. Your past understanding of conspiracy doesn't apply, etc. There's no tie to any preceding cognitive context. Now let's see if we could get an induction out of that. There is a word that means item of knowledge tending to establish or prove an idea. And that word is evidence. We could then say that what we mean by no basis is no evidence. No perceptual evidence, in other words, no observations. And no conceptual evidence. In other words, no logical process either of induction or deduction. Of course, here we have to tip our hats to Aristotle, who told us that these were the only two ways to get knowledge. So there, you would have to know that or you'd be stopped here. In other words, though, there is no relationship between the claim and anything cognitive. Whether it's observed facts now or in the future, or past premises, including past definitions or past knowledge of any kind. Now, I want you to get one last point at least, and then we'll stop for today. This is a cognitive, not a linguistic issue. It is not a question of, have any words or statements been uttered by the person to really support his statement? That is not the question. For example, I stand up here, I look at the TV monitor, and I say, there's three different locations pictured: San Francisco, New York, and me in Irvine. And somebody out here raises his hand or on the phone says, what's your basis for that? And I shrug and say, I'm in a hurry, I don't care to discuss it. Is this an arbitrary claim on my part about the three? After all, I didn't give you a jot of evidence. No, it is not. I am speaking within a context where it's understandable and legitimate for me not to waste time, and you should know this. Plus, I know and you know that the evidence is accessible to anyone who wants to bother to take a look. So the fact that I don't verbalize such evidence does not make it arbitrary. Arbitrary means detached from any rational, contextually available evidence. But if the evidence is available, the fact that I don't enunciate it proves zero. Now, I think we're going to stop at that point out of necessity, and we will pick up 2 weeks from today by finishing up our better definition of the arbitrary and then going into the question of why it's wrong. So, by judicious cutting, including omitting the end of the class, I have 6 seconds to say thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening around the world. I left off with the statement that an arbitrary statement is a claim without a basis, neither perceptual nor conceptual. And we concluded this by induction from several cases. It is a statement detached from any rational, contextually available evidence. And I'm going to pick up right from that point. If Shirley MacLaine, carrying on our example of last time, had said the following about her past lives, it would have been okay. If she had said a speech to this effect, all available rational evidence is admissible. It counts. I mean by life exactly what scientists define it as today. I mean by soul just what Ayn Rand says. I accept the whole current context of knowledge, including everything we know about consciousness's dependence on the brain. And I still say that my past lives influence my current behavior. Then her statement would not be detached from available evidence, even though she has stated none herself. In that case, we could, if we wanted, easily relate her statement ourselves to what we already know, grasp that it's a contradiction, and pronounce her statement false. That is completely different from the epistemological situation that I gave you last time, when Shirley MacLaine's statement amounted to, I transcend and throw out some or all of our current rational definitions and context. So to sum up, what does it really mean to say that something is arbitrary? When somebody says X is so-and-so, whether it's God, the immortality of the soul, the past life, you name it, which of two things is he saying? One is arbitrary, one is not. If he says, I am talking about X, whatever it is, using all the relevant concepts as we rationally define them now, I'm holding the total of the cognitive context, all of our knowledge, including all ideas that are reducible to sensory evidence, present or to come. All of that is welcome in determining the status of my claim. That is not something detached from all available evidence. It's not arbitrary. Versus, I am talking about X in a sense transcending the knowledge, the data, the concepts, the definitions, the whole context available to us. That is arbitrary. Now, I put in those two statements the evidence present or to come because I want to be able to cover cases like what I cited last time where I look at the screen and I say it shows three locations. In other words, the evidence is available, but you have not yet sought it out. So it doesn't have to be the evidence that's actually pushed into your face. As long as I say so on a real basis and I can specify, I can define the specific evidence to come and how you get it. It's allowed to include evidence to come. As again, Shirley MacLaine, who says, yes, evidence is coming after you die. So the essence of the issue with that understanding is, does the claim permit you to hold the total cognitive context? Fine, no problem, not arbitrary. The arbitrary is when it's detached from all and any evidence. It's simply not connected with, not relatable to anything we know or are rationally able to learn. Harry, where are you? Oh, you're over there. Okay. Now let us make some integrations. The echo has just started. I guess it took a while to get across the country. We should make some integrations with the principles we've already acquired about knowledge from Aristotle and Ayn Rand. Somebody has to mute themselves. We learn from Aristotle the need of observation and of logic. And that was a requirement of our being able even to reach the concept of a proved statement, and thereby of an unproved or baseless one. We learn from Ayn Rand by a further series of inductions the importance of context and integration to knowledge. So at this point in our development, we already have complex information about what is required for something to qualify as knowledge. Well, we are now then in a position immediately to say about the arbitrary what? It represents a complete violation of everything we know about knowledge. It breaks every known rule of cognition. No observation on its behalf. No logic. No evidence. No context. No integration. Therefore, it certainly can't qualify as any form or level or degree of cognition. It is anti-cognition. And this much is just a deduction from the nature of the arbitrary conjoined with our knowledge of what is inherent in knowledge, which we learned during our objectivity discussion. Is that going to take the echo away? Now we are quite a way towards establishing our principle that the arbitrary is neither true nor false. Now I'll make a concession here. It is theoretically possible for someone at this point to deduce from the anti-cognitive nature of the arbitrary the ultimate conclusion that arbitrary statements are neither true nor false. But I hasten to add, I do not believe that anyone apart from Ayn Rand would actually be able to make such a deduction meaningfully as against rationalistically, unless he first performed one more induction, a second induction. So let us ask, what else is common to our three instances? Remember, the two men up here at the lectern, Shirley MacLaine in her past lives and Johnny Cochran in his police conspiracy. What else is common to these instances besides the fact, which we already know, that they are inherently detached from evidence and therefore prohibit the establishing of any relationships, whether to old knowledge or new data? Let us approach this second induction by taking the items one at a time and asking, what can we do cognitively with them? For example, can we refute any one of them? Can we prove any one of them? Can we reason about any one of them? Can we at least legitimately hypothesize anyone and give it a degree of probability, positive or negative, or even sheer possibility? Now, you should be able to see by going over each case that it is impossible to perform any cognitive action in regard to arbitrary claims. For example, I'd have to take every cognitive action against every claim, so I'm giving you a sample, and if you go home, find a range and the frequency. But for example, can you refute Shirley MacLaine by showing that she contradicts something you know? Now remember, we're treating her here as Shirley MacLaine the arbitrary, not the good Shirley MacLaine who we can refute. If we try to show her that she contradicts something that we know, her answer would be, what? I didn't make this up. All these people say, oh, this is the only stock and trade that they have. It only seems to be a contradiction. It's not really a contradiction. Given our present knowledge, our limited knowledge, it looks like a contradiction, but she transcends that. Now to refute means to demonstrate a clash with something already known, even if only with the law of contradiction. So suppose someone claims there is a round square behind Venus, and you say, well, I've never been there, but it's impossible. It contradicts the very laws of logic. And he says, no, it really doesn't. If you were to see this unique round square and grasp the sense of round and square that I mean, which is not like any sense you ever could imagine, you'd see that it's perfectly consistent. If only you had this higher perspective, which you poor peasant don't have. Now, you cannot refute that round square on those terms. You cannot refute even a round square or a direct self-contradiction. You cannot refute a claim which states that one of its essential features is that it can't be considered in relation to anything else you already know. Is that clear? And now, by the same token, you can't do anything else with it either. You can't prove any such claim. How would you do it? By pointing to what facts as the basis. It has no relation to any facts. Could you reason about such a claim? Well, reason about it how? From what observations? From what premises? Bringing in what data? You cannot, and this is very important, even hypothesize such a claim rationally. Not even with a glimmer of possibility. Because a hypothesis must have some basis in evidence, however small. And these claims are inherently detached from any basis. In other words, and here you actually have to go home and try it out, instance after instance, until you see that the induction is inescapable. Go home and take these arbitrary claims or any other ones you want and try to prove, refute, reason about or hypothesize as you wish. And if you do, you will easily come to the conclusion after, depending on your acuity, after enough examples across a broad enough range, there is nothing whatever that your mind can do with these claims. It is literally impossible to think about them. Now, I'd like you to get this straight, please, right here. If you're taking notes, this is the thing to take, because otherwise you're going to ask this in the question period. You can, C-A-N, think about the psychology or the motives of the people who propound the arbitrary. You can think about the dreadful consequences of their claims. In other words, you can think about the cause and the effect. You can even think about whether any given claim really is arbitrary, because we stressed last time that it's not always obvious. But I am saying this, if and when you see that a claim is arbitrary, then you cannot think about its cognitive status at all. You can't think about its validity as a claim. You can't weigh it, assess it, determine its probability, its possibility, its invalidity, its truth, its falsehood, anything. It is non-processable. A rational mind stops in its tracks in the face of any attempt to process such a claim. Now, I want to introduce a word that we're going to make big hay out of subsequently. A rational mind is functionally paralyzed in this context. It's paralyzed if it tries to do anything cognitive, to weigh, to judge, to process, to classify. There is nothing it can do to move one cognitive step in any direction. Once the arbitrary sets the task. So if you try to do it, you just sit there. You cannot move a muscle without cheating on the assignment. So remember the word paralysis. When I write my book, I'm going to have a whole chapter on paralysis. This is an infantile, but adult paralysis. And it's all over induction. It's one of the most helpful techniques. Unfortunately, that's not written down, so I can't discuss it. So, our first induction stated that the arbitrary is that which is detached from any evidence, severed from any relationship to a cognitive context. Our second induction is all such claims are detached from thought In other words, from any thought, from the very possibility of thought. In other words, all claims detached from evidence are claims detached from the possibility of thought. That's your second induction. You don't have to write that, but it's one of the key points here. Now, the key is the two inductions together. If you merely observe the second, the one we've just covered, you noted that in the three cases you were mentally paralyzed and had no idea how to proceed. That shows nothing epistemologically and could have many explanations. For example, maybe you don't know enough yet about a given field and that's why you can't think. Or maybe this is just too difficult a subject matter for you. You never took channeling 101 at Columbia University in the physics department. Or you didn't have time to follow all the OJ details, etc. There are many common sense reasons why it could be the case that you just can't think about X. So that per se is not a decisive point. It's when you realize that you're paralyzed because the idea is inherently detached from evidence. When you realize that you can't think because under the circumstances it is impossible for anyone to think, then your paralysis becomes significant. Your paralysis in the face of utter lack of evidence is a crucial epistemological fact, which leads directly to a crucial conclusion. And from here, it's all deduction. A claim inherently detached from thought can have no relationship to reality. In other words, that's a very simple statement. If it's outside of the realm of cognition, outside of our ability to think about at all, we obviously can't claim that it's based on reality or that it goes against reality. We have no clue what, if any, relationship to reality it has. We can't tie it to facts in any way, for or against. And for the same reason, no one can see it as possible in reality or impossible in reality, because there's no basis for any utterance about its relation to reality, because we can't think about it. And remember, we can't even use any contradictions that we might discover. So we can't even go so far as to say, well, we know it's impossible. In sum, if a claim is outside human cognitive processing, then there is no way to establish any connection between the claim and reality. That's just a mere restatement, a corollary, versus a true deduction from the fact that it's outside of cognitive process. So, I don't have to keep saying this, right? Here is the point now where we need to bring in and integrate our earlier knowledge of true and false. The concepts true and false. These concepts come very early in a child's development. Many long years before he can grasp the arbiter, the concept of the arbiter. And it's not difficult at all. All children, I think even most mental retards, have no trouble reaching the concept of true and false. True means corresponds to facts, conforms to the facts, recognizes the facts, whatever. And false goes against, contradicts, not the way the facts are, etc. Now, assuming we bring in this early knowledge of true and false, we need merely observe that both designations involve some relationship between a mind and reality. When you say your statement corresponds, that means you recognize. The statement in itself doesn't do anything. But it means you recognize some fact of reality. You see something. Your statement captures or conforms to something in reality. In other words, therefore, you grasp that X corresponds to reality. And so you can reach the concept truth. So the method is you establish a certain positive relationship between your consciousness and reality, and then identify that relationship as truth. And the exact same thing goes for false. You can grasp that a statement contradicts reality and is therefore false only by recognizing a negative relationship between the statement and reality, and thereby grasping this is false. So both true and false as concepts necessarily involve a relationship, whether good or bad, but either way definite, between a consciousness and reality. And in the arbitrary case, we have the exact opposite of both. No relationship, no connection at all between our statements and reality. So in that sense, reminding you of all part, it is like a parrot babbling. 2 + 2 = 4. Now you can call that language if you want, but epistemologically, it is noise. I don't go on the crusades to say that minor birds can't speak. What I say is they do not use concepts. Cognitively, their speaking is noise. I don't care whether you call it speaking or not. Noise has no cognitive status as true or false, just as a parrot's babbling has neither. Now you see that if somebody tells you your statement is false, that is a compliment, because it designates a specific error as against a total break with reality. If someone accuses your claim of being arbitrary, this is a much greater insult if it's unwarranted than if he simply said, you are wrong. And I could tell you a story about that too someday, of something I once said to Ayn Rand and her reaction, but I'll have to leave that. You ask me if you want to know. The arbitrary has no cognitive classification, and therefore no classification in relation to reality. The whole point of the induction is to see that it's cut off from cognition and reality. It's pure babbling. As Ayn Rand once said about it, it is as if nothing had been said, because nothing of cognitive value or validity has been said. So now it becomes a practical issue, and we can deduce the answer from what we've said so far. What specifically should we do when confronted by an arbitrary statement once you know it's arbitrary? How do you handle it? And the objectivist answer is, forget about it. Don't talk to babblers and don't babble yourself. In other words, dismiss the arbitrary without thought. Now, if you're taking a sentence down, take that one and underscore without thought. Now, it is not true that for objectivism, thought is always good. No. What ethics would it be that would say thought is always good? The commandment is thou shalt think. That'll be intrinsicism. And she even says in Galt's speech, if I were to use your language, I would say that was the commandment, but I won't use your language. Thought is not a virtue when it is impossible, or when the conditions require you to violate the proper laws and methods of thought. So don't be shocked that you should do something without thought. It's a situation in which thought is not possible. To tell somebody don't think about the arbitrary is a sheer corollary of the fact that he can't think about it. Your only choice is to pretend to think about it for social reasons, which is honest and self-correct, or throw out at once an active and never said. Now, I'm sure you know myself, so length and far, throwing it out doesn't mean you're anyway unsure, ignorant, whatever you are in question. It doesn't mean you're open to the pathologism, the mechanics, the reasons, the objection. You are sure, if you're an objectivist, that all these are non-cognitive and therefore no concern to mine at all. Therefore, you must not say about these arbitrary claims what you could legitimately say about ideas where rational evidence is available, but you haven't or can't decipher it. For instance, you're a juror in a murder case, and the evidence is so tangled and contradictory, and the witnesses are so eloquent, and you throw your hands up and you say, I just can't decide. It's just too complicated. But you cannot reasonably do that in regard to the arbiter. You can't say, I don't know, I can't decide, I have no opinion, I'm suspending judgment. Because in regard to the arbiter, you do know. You must decide. You should have an opinion. You should not suspend judgment. Your judgment should be, since there is no evidence to untangle, this is unthinkable, undiscussable, and inadmissible. Now, I have a great question before we go on to the next part on the arbitrary, but first I will take a hand from any of my live or TV locations if you want to ask, actually talk fast enough to get an extra 2 minutes. Do I see a hand in New York? In New York. Candidate number one. Not one person. Yes.
How about that question that you suggested a minute ago about your discussion with Ayn
Rand? Oh, well, that's just a personal note. When I was very young, I was maybe 20, 18, 19, and I didn't follow her argument for something at all. And, you know, I was barely fledged or civilized at that stage of the game. And I told her more or less directly, in fact, directly, in a polite way, I said, you know, I know that you believe in reason, but it seems to me that you believe, I think it was causality or something like that, strictly on faith, because I don't grasp any reason that you have to say what you're saying. I never saw her get so angry. And many, many times I said, I disagree with you, you know, right? What about this and this? That never faced her. But to tell her to her face that it was faith, she blew up totally. Totally. She thought that was completely intolerable, and she wasn't going to accept that. And we had a whole new set of arrangements that if I thought there was no reasons at all for something she said, ask somebody else. And only when I found out what her reasons were and had specific objections could I come back and talk to her. You know, because to me, whether it's faith or it's wrong, you just said whatever came to you, you know. Now the question do I have somebody in Irvine?
Irvine?
Wave your hand or just speak up.
Speak up.
In San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Okay, well I just want to get in this one very quick point.
Which is that
even though you banish it from your mind, you forget about it, etc., there is a sense in which the negative holds the fort in terms of action. In other words, you act in regard to the arbitrary as if it hadn't been said, which means you act as if it hadn't come up, which means you act as if it wasn't there. You, for instance, when you sit down to eat, having taken normal precautions, if somebody says this food is poison, you say that's arbitrary. You don't go and subject it to analysis, you just eat. The assumption is no evidence of poison, there is no poison. You see? And reality makes that arrangement for you because there's billions of things that aren't there. If you can take a formulation like that. So you can't possibly check them out, so you only go if there's evidence. And if there's no evidence, you just blithely ignore it totally. And in that sense, your action, people say, you think you're being so fair, you're not considering it. But actually, you are acting as though there's nobody next to you, and you are acting as though there's no previous lives, and you are acting as though OJ is guilty, and I say, hear, hear, absolutely right. Okay. Now, I want to introduce a new point. After years of teaching this topic, I have a new clarification that may help some of you while totally destroying others. Actually, this point never occurred to me when I was writing OPAR or in any previous teaching, But a lot of stuff occurs to me in connection with the OT course, this course, that didn't before. Now, I'm warning you, beware, because I'm going to about to put something over on you exactly as is done in graduate school. And if you get the technique, you have one less chance of dying of terminal cancer in graduate school. The odds are still bad, but so be careful. And I'll untangle it all before the half hour is up. Take this case, invented in honor of Harry Binswanger. It's a sort of a strange case for his wedding, but it's the one that occurred to him. Someone comes to you and asserts arbitrarily that Harry Binswanger gave a three-hour seminar in his New York apartment on Hegel's logic last night. He gave it to a large group of 50 objectivists in the middle of the night, starting at 4 a.m. East Coast time. And I say to the person, why do you say that? And he says, well, that's what Harry wanted as his bachelor party. And you say, but how do you know that? What is your basis for that? I say so. That's my opinion of what happened. Now, in this case, the statement is 100% arbitrary, obviously. But it seems abundant evidence is available, probably decisive evidence one way or the other, if you expend the time and effort to acquire it. For example, we could ask Harry or Gene, or better, talk to each of them separately to see if there's any contradiction in their stories. We could interview objectivists in the New York area, see if any of them went. We could check it out with the doorman in the building, neighbors, the lists on the internet, lists of lyceum for the area. We could mount hidden cameras, see whether dozens of young people ever come again like that in the middle of the night. We could check out the sales of Hegel's logic in the vicinity. There's all kinds of available evidence, so it seems. And ultimately, it seems that this evidence, if we accumulated it, would be rationally decisive one way or the other. I mean, it's supposed to be put Harry Binswanger on a lie detector test. And he passes with flying colors. So, the question becomes, what do you do in a case like this? Can we say that the claim about his Hegelian bachelor party is true? Oh, no, obviously we haven't checked it out. Can we say it's false? No, we haven't even tried to refute it. And remember, seems that it's possible to refute it if it is false, because there's so much available evidence to tie it to. Well, should we then work to see if it's true or false? I'd like to see by a show of hands how many think that that would be the fairest solution, to go and survey the evidence, try to gather it, and then make a decision on that basis. You can just wave your hand, I won't ask you. I can't see one hand. Well, what should you do to be reasonable in this situation? Well, let's ask first, is this a case of the arbitrary or not? Well, I don't know. I can make a case both ways, it seems. On the one hand, all a guy that put it forth had to offer is, I say so. So that's an arbitrary statement if ever I heard it, right? On the other hand, there is lots of seemingly available evidence. So maybe it's not arbitrary. I mean, it can be detached from the whole context if there's all those facts out there crying to be integrated. So, let's leave that for a minute. We'll come back. What should a rational man do? Should he check out an arbitrary hypothesis if it's actually possible to do so? Now, I was asked that question around 1960. And my answer was always no. It's still an arbitrary statement. And you shouldn't check it out even if you could get 100% reliability And I argued like this. The person making this statement has a direct contradiction. He's saying, I hypothesize that X, this bachelor party, for which there is no evidence, is possible. In other words, he's saying, it's possible there is some evidence for this, and there's no evidence, which is a contradiction. He's not saying merely such a thing can happen in some circumstances. He's not saying simply Harry has the general capacity to hold such a session. He's saying it may actually have taken place last night or may tonight, so let's check it out. And my answer was always the claim that this may have occurred is the only possible justification for checking it out, but this may itself is purely arbitrary, has not a jot of basis, and therefore is non-cognitive, and therefore there's no justification whatever for checking it out. So I used to go down, you know, in flames in classes saying you shouldn't check it out even though it's possible. It's immoral and irrational to check it out even though it's possible. And of course, the professors thought that was fabulous because it goes to show what a dogmatist I was. I knew that something, but I put morality above truth, and you know, the whole business. So, was I right? I don't think so anymore. Because I have a more deep approach. And the first thing that happens now when I get put these typical graduate school questions is not what do I answer, but why did you ask that? And the interesting, much deeper and much more revealing question is, how is this kind of dilemma even possible? We painstakingly induced that the arbitrary is detached from evidence and thus induces paralysis. Well, then how then can there be such a thing as an arbitrary claim which can be objectively checked out by reference to a whole bunch of sensory and rational evidence? And the reason we're having a problem knowing what to do is we have a solid contradiction, right? Now, what is the real answer to this contradiction? There is no such thing as the situation I put forth. Only a professor could make it up. The hypothesis about Harry's logic party cannot be checked out. Can never be verified or refuted. Never. Except if you give up reason. And then you have a lot of troubles verifying. Now, I got to explain this to you. This is where, as soon as the professor gives you a puzzle, you know right away there's something vicious. Because he wouldn't put it in the form of a puzzle if it wasn't to destroy the mind. Now, I pulled a deliberate professorial con man trick on you in order to get you into this stage. And I did it because I hope you can learn from it, because there are hordes of objectivist graduate students, thoroughly confused, who fall for these old tricks on a daily and even hourly basis, judging by my mail. And I used to fall for them too and bring them back to Ayn Rand, who was continually amazed at my gullibility. She said, you didn't see through that? And I'd say, well, no, you know, I mean, we could check it out, and he didn't give any evidence, so it's arbitrary, but it's not arbitrary. And she'd look to the ceiling and roll her eyes as if, what is the use of talking to another human being? Now, the trick is to insinuate a contradiction into your mind by making you focus on a concrete without reference to any principle. In effect, I set the situation up so that for you to follow and understand what I am saying, you have to become concrete. And that leaves me free to be utterly unprincipled. because you're so busy. It's truly a sleight of hand. You're like a prestidigitator, where you can't see what he's doing because he moves his hand so fast and you're looking at the wrong spot. And that is what all higher education in the United States, in all humanities, consists of. It consists only of excellence at this. In fact, you have to be excellent at this by definition, or you can't get a PhD, because getting a PhD consists of demonstrating that you can take in other faculty members by this same method. So let me show you how it works. And the simplest way to reveal this trick is to go back to egoism, which is turning out to be a very valuable lecture, much more than I thought at the time, because it has everything important about induction in it. Only I didn't know it when I gave it. But I want to show you, remind you about some things that we said in egoism, and then show you how it applies to this trick today. Do you remember when we discussed altruism in Lecture 3? I said, don't let your opponent delimit the scope of his theory. Don't let him say, I don't mean, self-sacrifice of your life for the world. I'm talking about a nickel for the poor. I'm talking about the lives of a few boys from Idaho for Bosnia. Other than that, I'm for selfishness all the way. Now, you remember that I stressed that you have to take altruism, if you are assessing it as a way of life, as an inductively reached universal principle of ethics, and then apply it across a whole range of situations and evaluate it, just exactly as we had to do to induce and validate egoism. We had to regard it as a universal, all-embracing principle. Philosophy can be approached only via principles. That is the essence of an inductive approach to philosophy. Now, we'll stay with this Lecture 3 for a minute, because then when you get the point on this, it'll be child's play to see it on the arbitrary. Imagine this dialogue. The altruist says to you, Mr. Needy is going to come begging to your door. And when he does, your duty is to give him your china. No more. Not your silverware, your rugs, or your furniture. After all, you have some rights too. Some sacrifice is good, but total sacrifice is ridiculous. We'd all die. So some selfishness is necessary and good too. Now, if you let an altruist say that, that is the greatest coup that he will ever achieve. Because what he accomplishes by you passing that on, saying nodding and say, okay, let's go on from there, is that the idea of principle has been silently but totally thrown out. The only issue now to focus on is who gets the china. And if you ever dream of going to an abstract level and saying to him, how do you reconcile such opposite ethical approaches? His answer is a total brush off in the form of, oh, this isn't a matter of theory we're talking about. Ethics is concerned with practical decisions. Don't you feel that the china is plenty? I discussed it with the Committee on Redistribution that we have among the arts professors at NYU, and we feel that this is fair for everybody. What do you feel? Now, that translation into there's only one principle. Ethics is obedience to my feelings or my group's feelings. Today, they call it intuitions. They actually call them intuitions. And they take polls of intuitions and ethics classes. And that's what the latest, it's not called philosophy anymore. It's the latest garbageology or whatever they do. Now, the cherry on the cake is the guy who puts forth this, I can't even think of a word that I could say in polite company, will come to you at the end and say, Mr. Needy will probably really appreciates you for having given him the china. So you're going to benefit from this too, from his goodwill. So you see, there is no conflict between sacrifice and selfishness. You could have them both, and by sacrificing a little, you'll be even more selfish. That is not satire. That is how these people, you can't say think, but how they string sounds together with periods in between. I'm speaking only of those who have taught for at least 20 years in a PhD program, because they have to learn these tricks till it becomes actually like a self-lobotomy, so that they don't know that it's going on, except when they want to. Now, let's make the exact parallel to the epistemological case. Here is the exact same dialogue, but condensed, because presumably you already get it. The advocate of the arbitrary says to you, when Mr. Wim comes to talk to you today, just accept one arbitrary statement from him. Just his first arbitrary hypothesis. That's it, no more. After all, you're a man of reason too. Some amount of the arbitrary is okay. I mean, it spices things up. It opens the doors to all kinds of possibilities we otherwise wouldn't have dreamed of. But too much is ridiculous. We never get anywhere. We need some real evidence too. You see the parallel? Again, there's no attempt to identify or reconcile two opposite principles, in this case of epistemology. He simply declares, one arbitrary hypothesis is plenty, and after that, reason all the way. Now, if you have not already left the room, you're lost. Completely lost at that point, if you don't say, I resign, I withdraw, or at least I retire from the discussion. If you open your mouth on that premise, you're finished, because this is what happened. You set out to check the arbitrary hypothesis about Harry Binswanger. And let's say you get 50 affidavits from 50 objectivists that they were studying Hegel with Harry Binswanger that night, and arbitrary proponent claps his hands and says, you see, Peikoff is wrong. We did prove an arbitrary statement. Proved it conclusively. 50 affidavits, the handwriting is there, the whole thing. So he looks at you and he smiles and says, you know, the arbitrary is not so arbitrary after all. Maybe the arbitrary can even be rationally proved. What do you think of that? Big grin. Now, at this point, if I'm watching from the sidelines, I'm ready to burst. And I say, excuse me, you have proved nothing at all with your 50 affidavits. If you can hypothesize this fantasy in the first place without any basis, why shouldn't I say without any basis that your 50 affidavits is just confetti from a conspiracy of liars? Prove that it isn't. Therefore, I say, I am right after all. You can't process the arbitrary. You can't prove or refute anything about it. At which point the defender of the arbitrary's turn to come back is, and what can he say? What? Don't be such an extremist. Everything can't be arbitrary. So let's decide communally or intuitively. Now, it certainly seems to me that counting 50 affidavits would be proof. If we allow Peikoff's objection, we're going to be swamped with the arbitrary. That's ridiculous. It's just like Mr. Needy wanting your silverware too. I mean, we got to draw the line somewhere, and now he's posing as the champion of balance and moderation and sanity. And then he says to the class, now how many of you feel with me that, leaving aside all these technicalities, 50 affidavits prove something after all? I mean, we have a court system, or are we going to live in fantasy the way Peikoff is talking about? And of course, the students all raise their hands. And so then the only debate comes down to, should we have arbitrary, only the first hypothesis, or every 10th hypothesis on Mondays or Thursdays in constitutional law, or only in astrobiology. How many feel? What do you feel, Miss Jones? Well, we'll register your feelings. Just take it down with the secretary. You get two votes because you're female. Plus Hispanic, you get another one. Gay, another one. So that's it. Now, that's unfortunately, this is an understatement, because it is not possible to satirize or overstate the absolute muck, the depraved corruption that passes out of the lips of every professor without exception that teaches this humanities at any college or high school in the United States or the civilized world today. That's as calmly as I can put it. Now, if you get the racket here, this is the racket. Obviously, I don't care about this because I'm out of school. But in case anybody wonders, this is why I do not go to graduations, because I become homicidal if I set foot on a campus. If the arbitrary, this is the racket. If the arbitrary is endorsed as a principle, then its advocate looks ridiculous, and his viewpoint wipes out all cognition. Just as if you endorse altruism as a principle, the advocate looks medieval and wipes out all survival. So the idea of these swine is to sneak the evil in now and then under the guise of not being extremists, just a little bit of it, camouflaging it wherever they can as its opposite, and emitting as loudly as they can at the same time a noisy devotion to reason, proof, selfishness, life, whatever. If you fall for this trick, remember that you have been warned. And it's not as obvious as this one. Whenever a professor asks you to puts two sentences on the board and says, what difference do you see between those two sentences? That is already death. If you try to say, well, one sentence has five words and the other has six, the question in your mind should be what? Why are we talking about the difference between those two sentences? What is the point? What is it supposed to illustrate? And if he says, well, we're using induction, then I think physical assault is the best. So, what causes the idea that you can objectively process an arbitrary claim? It is the failure to think in principle, the failure to insist on inductive generalization. It's the willingness to discuss, consider, listen to, or allow into your thought an example or a chart or a sentence apart from a principle. In other words, the cause of our dilemma is an unprincipled acceptance of or indulgence in someone's irrationality, even if only accepted hypothetically for 5 minutes to follow his mental process. And of course, you know, if you uphold one instance of unreason, you destroy reason across the board in every branch of philosophy. So my final conclusion reverts to the point that there is no case, none whatsoever, not a single one, where you can process the arbitrary. Not if you uphold reason as a matter of principle. Of course, you can do anything you want if you dispense with principles, except that you're not doing anything except modern philosophy. Here's a statement made to me nearly 40 years ago by Ayn Rand. Somebody else's irrationality should never activate your mind. It should never stampede you into a cognitive judgment or inquiry of any kind, other than a psychopathological inquiry about the person. In other words, your cognition, including whether or not to start the process, should never be at the mercy of a maniac or an irrationalist. Or let's borrow from Johnny Cochran. There should be no rush to judgment or to think. Only reality, which includes other people's rational statements, can properly lead to any cognitive quest. I thought that was helpful. Now, in closing on the arbitrary, I want to just integrate it briefly with the other topics we've covered in this course. Reason is man's means of survival. Well, we now see that the arbitrary is a major threat to reason, a derailment of it from its job of cognition, so that if you integrate, that should lead you to the conclusion that the arbitrary is a threat, therefore, to productivity and to survival itself. And do you see any world-scale evidence of this? Yes. Any civilization ruled by the arbitrary, and usually the arbitrary starts with what letter? F for faith, which is just a religious variant of the arbitrary. Wherever there is widespread faith, that is acceptance in the absence of evidence, there is widespread poverty and misery as against the few errors of logic and abundance. Integrate with egoism. The epistemological essence of the arbitrary is pure selfishness. If I don't have evidence, I throw it out of my mind. I won't spend one second of my precious life on the whole world's babbling. In other words, I come first in epistemology too. That's a good integration, don't you think? Everyone, you should do that. We used to have parties where you put 100 principles in a paper bag and just pull out two at random, and you had to connect them, and you had to connect them in rhyme. Justice. Indulging in the arbitrary is a perfect example of something volitionally bad that people do. And therefore, justice demands an appropriate negative from you if it's within your power. And what is that negative here? Don't sanction the person by discussion or argument, which is what he most wants. His ultimate hope is to get from you the agreement that you're both involved in legitimate cognition, even if you disagree about some point. So the epistemologically correct policy, throw it out, is the morally correct policy. It is specifically the just response. Just say, I refuse to talk to you about it. Now, by now you should be inducing from these brief weekly integrations the conclusion that each new objectivist idea integrates separately with every other objectivist idea. So that if you keep on integrating, you're going to end up at some point not with a disconnected heap of theories or principles, but with an integrated, organized, comprehensive, total system. And I'll have more to say about that later, but that should be starting to occur to you at this point. You don't start out validating a philosophy, but at a certain point, you've got one on your hands, if you're doing it properly. Now I want to give you your assignment. That finishes the arbitrary, and it finishes epistemology.